Welcome to On Farm Trials with the PNW Farmers Network, where we explore the many trials that come along with cropping systems innovation in the inland Pacific Northwest. Plenty of questions get asked while farming across this region, and together, we're digging into what it's like to try to answer some of them as producers, researchers, and the many other professionals in the field that get things done. We're glad you're here. I'm your host, Carol McFarland. Today, we are on the home place of Mr. Russ Zenner, who has retired from the Russ and Kathy Zenner farm, but is actively still engaged with vested interest in the Zenner family farms. And we're really looking forward to hearing your career retrospective, Russ. Thank you so much for participating in the podcast and for having me out today.
Well, thank you for being here. And I'm looking forward to sort of sharing our history.
Oh, I'm very excited to hear about it. You are a legend in the region. Would you please share a little bit about yourself, your farm, and who you did farm with, and how you're still engaged with the Zenner Family Farms?
Yes. I was raised on the farm. My dad was a second generation. My grandfather immigrated from Luxembourg in 1908. Ended up in Uniontown, Washington, and married a second-generation German girl that had family ties that got them into farming in about 1911. And they raised 10 children. My grandfather was able to get all of his sons started farming in the North Idaho region. And my grandparents set an example of opportunity for their children, a love for agriculture that I feel very blessed to have that stewardship and opportunity with my grandparents that was passed on to my father's generation. And we provided opportunity for our children. None of them decided to be farmers. They all got degrees, master's degrees, and have had very successful professional careers, but we've ended up in the extended family, Clint and Alicia Zenner, farming our farm now, and just feel very blessed to have had the opportunity to be in a profession that I just loved, and an opportunity to manage natural resources, and again, it was my grandparents that set the example.
That's a great legacy. Thanks for sharing. We are here at your place outside of Genesee. Would you describe a bit more about your farming conditions, the moisture and soil and kind of standard rotation, some of the management history?
Yes. Well, for those of you that may not know where Genesee is, we're just south of Moscow, Idaho, east of the Washington border, about 15 miles, and high rainfall area, about 22 inch annual cropping, part of the winter wheat production region, still the primary crop, but raising spring grains, pulse crops, got some alfalfa. Cattle have historically been a part of the farm. In recent years, we've had not only been involved in shepherd's grain, flour, but our son and daughter-in-law, our son married a Lebanese girl from Miami, whose mother had a very good hummus recipe, and they are now in the hummus business with Zaka Hummus, using garbanzos from our farm. But we've taken sort of the trying to cash in on the environmental benefit of no-till farming, reduced tillage, and going to the marketplace with some food products.
Nice. I saw a little bit about that and being on the leading edge of the Vision Project with three pillars of sustainability and thinking about climate change and crop nutrition as well as soil sustainability with that product and identity preservation as part mm-hmm. of a values added space in the market. Do you want to talk any more about that?
Well, our first experience was with Shepherd's Grain. We were one of the Carl Coopers and Fred Fleming, and then there was a handful of other growers that were involved in that very first year of Shepherd's Grain. And It was sort of an outgrowth of the Pacific Northwest Direct Seed Association, trying to perfect no-till cropping management. That was a goal. One of our goals early on was to take advantage in the marketplace of the environmental benefit of direct seeding. And Carl and Fred had started this company on their own. And then some of the early growers in that group were charter members, founding board members of PNDSA. And just was very fortunate to be part of that group. And that sort of got us involved in the retail side of it, being connected to consumers, where we had all of that group had been commodity growers for their entire career. And getting into a market with consumers that had an interest in how the food was grown, and you know, the impact on the environment of how we grew food, was a very rewarding experience for a commodity producer. And we all shared that. That was in about 2003. Fast forward another 10 years, and our son and daughter-in-law started Zacha Hummus. Janine does not have a competitor that can trace the beans back to the farm in the family. That whole journey has provided a lot of inspiration to do better with how we farm, be much more environmentally sensitive to how we're producing food, price advantage in the marketplace by producing food that people are willing to pay a premium for. Just, it takes financial risk out of it, but reward you for doing good things.
Awesome. Okay. So I have to say, on this podcast, the Direct Seed Association has come up quite a lot. And as a founding member of the Direct Seed Association, would you be willing to share a little bit about the history of the inception of the Direct Seed Association and how it came to be and why?
Certainly. I'm going to back up a little bit before then, because it has an influence on why I became involved with the Direct Seed Association. But I was very fortunate in my career. I've got a BS in Ag Econ from University of Idaho, worked in the farm credit system for a couple years, planned eventually to come back to the farm, but I was only 2 years in farm credit, and we had a farm expansion opportunity and decided to come back. And one of the first volunteer positions I got hooked into was the Latah County Soil Conservation District Board of Supervisors. And what I learned as far as soil conservation in that position had a profound influence over my natural resource management goals in my career. Understanding the implications of topsoil loss, water erosion, wind erosion, tillage erosion. And the more I learned there, the more I became convinced that we've got to do a better job of farming to sustain the resource. And we are so blessed in this Palouse region with the incredibly productive sort of new soils, young soils that Mother Nature gave us. And it was apparent that we were degrading this very rapidly. It's not a criticism of all the farmers. My dad, my uncle farmed that way. My grandfather farmed. That's the best they knew. But I was convinced that we had to do better. And that sort of, I guess, inspired me to be more involved in some of the research efforts. And I attended some of the early conservation tillage conferences that were prior to the STEEP research effort. There's probably a lot of you out there that don't remember STEEP. It was a big part of my life and my productive careers. Combination of WSU, University of Idaho, and Oregon State University, ARS, Portland, the Pullman Land Management Unit, sort of a joint effort to the acronym STEEP, with Solutions to Environmental and Economic Problems on Agricultural Land. And during that time period, I was also involved in the USA Dry Pea and Lentil Council and served as chairman of the research committee for that group, which led to my position on the STEEP Research Advisory Committee. And that the STEEP project was sort of successor to this original conservation tillage effort, which there was a lot of frustration by growers that felt we needed to be moving towards less tillage, no-till, and a lot of the research effort was being done on conventional tillage ground. We needed to have variety trials in this environment, and the other part of it was just even educating researchers on what we're trying to do in no-till, and for them to have the equipment, that was a big hurdle early on to get the research community up to speed and have the funding for the equipment we needed to do all of this. And the other part of it was to have more diversity in the rotations. I grew up my early years, winter wheat and dry green peas primarily were the two commodities grown in this region. And one of the early conservation tillage research effort projects was done at Pullman, Washington, very similar rainfall that we have. And they went to a three-year rotation, eliminated the moldboard plow, and maintained very good yields. And that my interest in seeing what was going on there inspired me to do some very early rotation changes and reduce tillage changes. But it was because of public funding for research. So that led into STEEP. And later on, we put together a little partnership group called VICO. Three like-minded friends, ended up four of us being in this partnership that sort of carried on sharing equipment, trying new drills, ideas to sort of further the effort with the incentive was we all believed that we've got to do a better job of managing this natural resource. We could see that the implications of tillage on this ground was just not sustainable. And we needed to farm with less tillage. And the other part of our goal in recent years is we've got to dramatically reduce the amount of man-made chemistry we're introducing into the environment on an annual basis. And the reliance on the extractive industries to provide the nutrients for these crops to grow. This whole arena of soil biology is a very exciting field now, can do a lot of this stuff to produce nutrient-dense food, which is our goal on the humus shelf, is to have the highest nutrient density of any humus product on the shelf. You know, we aren't there yet, but doing a lot of things to hopefully get there. But that's sort of the history on sort of the research effort I was involved in. Part of the VICO group effort, we actually ended up hiring the Latah County Extension agent, Dave Barton, in those days, who came on board for our little partnership thing, agronomics, and led us into the whole technology field. Dave is the one that started the no-till breakfast in Lewiston, Idaho, and they expanded in the Pacific Northwest region. We were very fortunate at VICO to have Dave's leadership and organizational skills to help us in that partnership. That partnership has led into the next generation, but they don't have a Dave Barton. And you can just see the efficiencies that Dave added to us in getting things done.
Do you want to expand on that a little bit more with details on, you know, what sort of things he introduced to your group as well as how?
Well, Dave left the University of Idaho because he believed in what we were doing. Well, he was very interested in being on the leading edge. And just our meetings, you know, whether it was once a month or six times a year or whatever, he came with an agenda. We provided input on what we wanted to get done.
Now, there's some power just in making a little bit of structure.
And, you know, where do we want to go? What do we want to do? How are we going to do it? Those types of things. We were very fortunate to have that asset, and he's still a great friend. We get him back occasionally for our annual VICO tours where we're looking at what the partners have done leading edge stuff and failures, those types of things. So that continues with Clint and the other guys in the second generation with that group. Still a very valuable asset for those young men in their operation. So
that definitely sounds like a lasting part of your legacy. Yeah.
Well,
at this point,
just very fortunate to be a part of it. Yeah.
That's great. And, well, and I know with groups like that too, especially if you're sharing equipment, if somebody wanted to do a similar group, what makes it long-term sustainable to have that kind of peer that we call that peer learning networks now?
Well, I would say one of the advantages we had, the four of us, Gary Esser, Wayne Jensen, Lee Druffel, and myself, we were very good friends socially. And we all had a passion for an understanding that we've got to do better in managing this natural resource. And to be successful, as far as any kind of sharing thing, there's give and take. That's been a, you know, it's been a hurdle every year. There's been some bumps. Like now we have haying equipment. We've got a big baler, a very efficient swather, getting around to a lot of acres, rake. And that's probably been the most challenging one for timing. One hay outfit for quite a few acres. They have a guy hired to run all that, but just logistically, if we had a Dave Barton leading that group, there would be less hurdles, but it has survived. You know, it's been over 20 years now, 25 years that partnership has survived. And originally it was sharing, we'd rented no-till drill, tried different no-till drills. Then it was spraying. They had a self-propelled sprayer, one of the first big self-propelled sprayers in this country. From there, haying equipment, trying to think of any other equipment we've had, all other minor stuff, but nearly everything that VICA owned jointly was something to let us get into another arena of efficiency and try new things. And typically a few years with a shared implement and everybody ended up having one. The farms have grown from that day, dramatic increase in acreage jointly of the acreage involved. But it's been a very, in my view, efficient way to sort of move up the food chain in efficiencies, and then just the sharing of knowledge of pushing the values of this group is we all had the belief that we had to contribute to pushing the envelope, doing something that nobody else was doing and share every year. And that was very powerful, as and then go around once a year and share information on what was going on there. Probably one of the experiences in my career that's been the most satisfying is to work with that group and with such great people and respect for them. To see that carrying on in the next generation is very satisfying.
That's neat. And you were, from what I understand, in this region, you were really at the leading edge and one of the first no-till farmers in this area. Would you like to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I wasn't the earliest one. Some of the earliest effort we can trace back to Mort Swanson, Guy Swanson, Exactrix. His father is the one that really started no-till in this region. Dick Lloyd down in the Nez Perce County area was one of the very early innovators. A lot of the yielder drill guys, that was the start of Mort Swanson's drill making career, were the earliest leaders. And the challenge for those guys was the cost of glyphosate, the lack of knowledge that it was going to take more rotation diversity to be really successful. And some of that knowledge came out of publicly funded research effort. Again, equipment. Mort made a very good drill, but it was big and heavy. And it was narrow. It wouldn't cover the acres. But once the major manufacturers got into drill production, there was more opportunities there. As we learned, as price of glyphosate came down, the three-year rotation and that early conservation tillage effort at Pullman, what we learned about rotation diversity, and it was a very minor change, but it took a lot of the risk of root disease influence on wheat production out of the equation. If you just went to a three-year rotation, that was huge back in the days when some of the foot rots type cephalosporium stripe was a very devastating disease back in those days in the two-year rotation, and especially with no-till.
And that was, sorry, just for clarification, then that was a winter wheat and then a spring crop?
Winter wheat and a pulse crop.
And a pulse crop. Right. Okay. So then when you went to the three-year rotation, that really helped break some of those cycles.
It did.
What did that rotation look like?
Well, it was just a winter wheat, spring grain, pulse crop.
Okay.
And then we had introduction of garbanzos in the 80s, some more diversity in the pulse crop leg of it. But you could do less tillage, more surface soil, surface residue, and take out this huge yield drag risk of some of these diseases that prevailed in a two-year rotation. Just going to one year away from winter wheat made a big difference. Mm-hmm. So that was a big deal in being able to make this thing work financially. And to this day, you're seeing a lot, the three-year rotation influence in this annual cropping region is still pretty significant. Mm-hmm. And then one of the other things, this was in 1995, I can't believe it's approaching 30 years ago, Monsanto sponsored a trip to the Dakota Lakes Research Farm. It was about 15 growers from the Pacific Northwest went back to see what Duane Beck was doing with that annual cropping system, no-till system they were doing on that 700-acre farm, and the implications it was having to that region on going from spring wheat, summer fallow to a very diverse rotation, corn, soybeans, pulse crops, annual cropping. I was part of that group. That's when I met Carl Coopers, who ended up being one of the founders of Shepherd's Grain. And a lot of that group ended up being on the PNDSA board, but that was a very motivational trip back to see what Duane was having success with and his enthusiasm for the need to treat the land better. And the productivity increase they had in that region doing what he was doing is profound. And I'll say a kudos for Duane Beck. I don't know of a man on this planet that has had more positive influence over cropping system sustainability than Duane Beck. I don't think he's gotten the awards he needs yet.
Speaking of being a legend.
Yeah, well, he inspired a lot of us and felt very fortunate to be a part of that group. And then subsequent years, there was more groups that went back. They got funding to send. A lot of people went back to that Dakota Lakes Research Farm, and it inspired us to try a lot of different things that we're still doing today. In today's environment, we're looking at multi-species cover crops with warm seasons in there and trying to find out which ones in our environment will work, and a lot to learn there yet.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit about your experience with that process, kind of trial and error of trying to translate some of the practices that we see working in other regions into this cropping system? I know that you have trees right outside your door here, so maybe it's a little bit easier.
We are high rainfall. I feel very fortunate where my grandfather started farming. Terrain here is steeper than a lot of that drier region in central Washington. So tillage erosion, just moving topsoil downhill, has been a significant contributor to resource degradation. There's still plenty of fence lines around the country where there's 8 or 9, 10 foot variation in soil height from one side to the other, and Mother Nature did not do that. that was smooth ground 130 years ago. So it's pretty easy to see the implications of tillage, and a lot of that was due to the moldboard plow. That started lessening that influence, I would say 80s, 90s, and it's, you know, the moldboard plow has lost its value in this region. There's still some of it happening, but dramatically less. But even some of these two-pass systems, very aggressive hoe drills are moving a lot of dirt downhill every year. And I think it would be interesting, some research efforts on just evaluating the tons of topsoil that are moved downhill in a single event. Start adding up the tons that are moving downhill, and you get up on the interface where there's topsoil and there's subsoil. Every time you do that, you're moving that subsoil strata farther down the hill, covering, if there's still topsoil there, there's still plenty of tillage erosion going on. We've got to get better than we're doing now.
Soil is such an important resource, and it's not exactly renewable. So I guess just to come back to the question of, you know, your experience of some of the trial and error of adapting some of these farming strategies that you see in other places, and bringing them here to your place in Genesee.
Well, I had the motivation from early in my career, believing that we've got to do a better job. And so in that regard, a lot of my educational activities were to address that. The no-till organizations, direct seed, those type of things. I reading the No-Till Farmer magazine, the main ag publications, always looking for ideas that we could maybe try on the farm. The trip to the Dakota Lakes Research Farm was a powerful motivator. Listening to people that are farming dry land, generally speaking, and, you know, what they're trying in sort of our environment, and then maybe even some of the warm seasons as we look at climate change now. One of the things I see is there may be less risk to doing re-crop winter canola with milder winters. That's been a huge hurdle for our continuous crop region, is to successfully do winter canola without losing a crop year. Jack Brown worked on it for many years in his breeding program, and just struggled to get consistent overwinter survivability of fall canola planted into, you know, whatever, whether it's garb ground or winter wheat ground, spring wheat ground. But we're starting to see more success with that. And I think it's the climate change influence on that is going to maybe give us another fall seeded crop, a broadleaf crop, that may be a big part of a rotation going forward.
Are you telling me you like the idea of climate change?
Well, it's
sorry, that was not a trick question.
No, it's a very good one. And you know, those are some of the things, my observations, and in my career, the last couple decades especially, we have drier late summers, drier early falls than we used to have in my early career. And that has put some challenges into trying to do these multi-species cover crops between crops like they do in the summer rainfall regions. Has put more challenge to make that successful. The productivity on the forage value of that, if we're trying to do it, even as a standalone crop, has been more challenges with these very dry summers. And one of the long-range weather forecasts I was just looking at today is predicting a high probability of a very dry summer in this region, starting early in spring. It's going to be some challenges to try to do some of this stuff. As I've gotten closer to retirement, I'm doing a lot more reading now, and I'm still very motivated to inspire Clint to push the edge on sustainable resource management, regenerative ag. I want our real estate asset to survive generation after generation. And I believe in the science of climate change. I believe in the human influence over that. And we've been involved in some of the early carbon sequestration activities. In fact, PNDSA had one of the first cropland contracts to sequester carbon in the world. We did a pilot project with Entergy. It's an energy company out of Louisiana, sort of a pilot project where we were paid so much an acre to continue our no-till cropping system. Since then, we've been involved in Shepherd's Grain, documenting. We had a group did extensive soil sampling on Shepherd's Grain farms. And if I remember the numbers right, we were sequestering about a ton per acre per year in that time period over the farms that they kept the data. Or, you know, that's the goal, is that maybe we can cash in on some of that. And, you know, just this winter, one of the things I've read about is this enhanced weathering of basalt rock. The implications of spreading this rock dust on cropland has the potential to dramatically improve the carbon sequestration capability of those soils. Things like that I think agriculture overall has to be taking a closer look at the environmental implications of how we're producing food. It's as the population of this planet increases, as our reliance on the extractive industries is still a big part of how we produce food, there's a lot of that's going to have to change, in my view. I'm hoping that we can be a part of the effort to lessen the negative implications of all of these activities that are prevalent in how we produce this very cheap food.
I hear that part of that, for in your mind, is also the responsibility to work toward growing more nutritious food.
Yes, well, that's the other side of it. David Montgomery's book, What Your Food Ate, I would suggest that to anybody that eats food. Sort of some history on what diet changes, how we produce meats, especially dairy, poultry, in this country has changed since the 40s, and the implications to human health in this country compared to other advancing countries in the world. Some of the disease issues that we're dealing with these days that is related to our diet. And, you know, being, you know, garbanzos in hummus on the shelf, shepherd's grain flour on the shelf, motivation that's coming from the marketplace is going to inspire further effort to address climate change issues in how we produce food. And I think there's opportunities there for economic enhancement to if you address that. And as you look at that whole arena there, a lot of the publicly funded genetic effort, variety development programs are based on bulk yield. And I think we need to be getting back to including nutritional density, maximizing, being more efficient in getting nutrients into that food that are healthy for the humans that are eating them or the livestock. Science is learning about the implications of multi-species plant roots in the soil, what that does to sort of supercharge the soil biology activity where we get that nutrient cycling process going. And our traditional monocrop cropping practices of the past, you just don't have the diversity of soil biology. Companion cropping, I think, maybe has some opportunities, but it's going to maybe require more on-farm cleaning capabilities. The Canadians, it appears, in some regions have been more successful than we have in the U.S. on that. Dryland regions, wheat, winter pea combination, garbanzo millet, I think it is, or I can't remember what the other one was with. The garbanzos, sort of a companion crop, but you run up to the problem with, you get to store it separate, it's usually small volume, and then to get somebody to go work it through the cleaning process to separate them. But again, it adds diversity to that soil biology. And this whole arena of what science is learning about the microbiome in the soil and the implications to nutrient density to human health, I think is just going to provide more opportunity in the marketplace to concentrate on nutrient density, nutritional value produced per acre, and then looking at improving organic matter of the soil, carbon sequestration capabilities of that soil, in addressing what we have to do to pull carbon out of the atmosphere and let Mother Nature do the work, is to me, is the frontier we're on now that's exciting.
Thanks for sharing all those thoughts. I'm hearing from you that maybe as you've been thinking over the years about this, maybe they could be described as management goals of more soil carbon, more nutritious food. Would you describe some of your management goals from early in your career and how that's evolved over the years?
Certainly. Well, early in my career, it was convinced that we had to do less tillage. So
I just did hear that too, yeah. Along this.
So in that regard, as we got better at that, my early thought was that if we can master no-till on my generation, the next generation is going to be able to coast.
How's that borne out?
So, unfortunately, the last 10 years of my career, I described as the longer I farmed, the less I knew, because of what science was learning that we didn't know prior. And the implications of what science was learning, the implications of the human influence over the climate, and you start to work all of that into the equation, and yes, no-till will be part of this, but it's going to take dramatically more than that. And it puts more pressure on the management. It's very simple to raise two or three crops, monocrop, go on forever. But we know what that is doing to the resource. And again, we've got to have more diversity in these cropping systems, in the introduction of livestock back onto crop ground appears to be adding a lot of diversity to soil biology. And I'll reference one of your recent quotes here today, that you cannot make topsoil. That there's been growers that are doing that with very diverse rotations for forage, intensive grazing. So there's opportunities out there, but most of those people are direct marketing.
Now, for the record, I think you might have misquoted me a little bit.
Well, I gave you a chance to correct it.
I
figured I'd get a response.
I think you went with a little bit hyperbole there.
Okay.
I believe that I said that soil is not the most renewable of resources. Which,
okay, we can check that.
I think with intentional management, as you're describing, there's room for that to be different. But
yes.
It has to be very intentional, I think.
It is. Well, and it's difficult to do. And so it's easy to move back and forth. And there's just a lot of farms that don't have that opportunity. And to move from the successful monocrop system to incorporating livestock, the forage value, if you're selling commodity livestock, it just is very difficult to compete. So there's other things you've got to have in that equation to be successful as far as more value for what you're selling. And then the diversity of livestock even that Gabe is using on his farm and this Will Harris is using on his farm. And there's, you know, what those people are learning and what science is learning now, it's going to take a while to develop more successes there.
Now, you did say you had cows on your place historically.
Yes.
And how was that integrated into your management at the time, and how did that meet your management goals?
Very little, yeah. Very, you know, I grew up with joy at taking out fences. And a lot of people my age did a lot of that as farm consolidation, cleaned up the fence lines, keep the cattle in the canyon. You know, for somebody that's a farmer and the livestock's a pain.
I've heard a little bit of that sentiment, but also some lamentation about all the fences that got taken out during that
right.
time.
Yeah, as we look at it now, insect species habitat and those old fence lines, things like that. There's we're probably going to wish we hadn't done all of that. And, you know, so the survivors have been farmers, generally speaking. That's their passion, skill set, and they were glad to see the livestock gone. So my experience in our operation, my brother and I were partners. He took the livestock end of it, and I did the farming end. And we moved to a generation where Clint was involved with livestock on a pretty big scale and loved it. But the opportunities he had in farmland just did not lend him hiring a full-time person to run the livestock. So we've rented out that range land. But since Clint has taken over the farm, we have done several grazing cover crop, grazing volunteer, third cutting of alfalfa grazing, just with cattle. We have not done multi-species livestock on our farm. Eric Odeberg, my neighbor, he did a large field, had a huge goat herd in that, and had a very successful multi-species cover crop mix. It's just incredible forage value. We're pretty excited about the success he had with that.
Wait. Now, Russ, when I interviewed Eric, who is the one who nominated you after watching over your fence line for years and being inspired, did I just hear you're looking over the fence line at his place and getting inspiration?
Certainly. Yes. That's, you know, it's been my career. You can learn from everybody. And it's exciting to see him doing what he's doing. And
it is.
It's wonderful to see the success. And we can all learn from that. Mm-hmm. Has been the part of it. And that's, you know, the thing that I've seen through the years, that guys trying to push the envelope and convinced we got to do it a better way, very willing to share their knowledge for the good of everybody.
It is.
That attitude and passion has just been fun to work around.
Could we circle back, actually? As you talk about being one of the founding members of PNDSA, I would really love to hear a little bit more about how that got going and that history. So you talked a little bit about kind of the prehistory to
right.
that, but really, how did that get going? What did it look like?
I can vividly remember after one of those conservation tillage meetings, annual research review it was, in the Tri-Cities, there was several of us, growers from Oregon, Washington, Idaho, sort of got into sort of the conference evaluation, and we expressed significant frustration that there wasn't more effort put into no-till practices and variety trials done on that. And I've talked a little bit about this already. Just having a research community that even believes what we're doing is the direction to go. And there was a lot of hurdles back then, and it certainly isn't as easy as it is now. And there were other no-till organizations already in existence on the North American continent, in Australia, very active. And that was sort of inspired. Some of the growers had been to some of those conferences, and the more we thought about it, we decided that we needed something like that. And we had some very inspired researchers to facilitate, encourage, be a part of that effort. Jim Cook was one of them, ARS and Pullman, Roger Vieseth at the University of Idaho, Don Wysocki was one of the early ones involved with that from Oregon. It was a very, exciting time, and just the passion of that leadership group involved there was very fun to be part of.
It sounds like it. So like your first board meeting, did you have a really good meeting agenda?
Barton wasn't there. So yeah, I don't know who developed the agenda for that, but Jim Cook and Roger Vieseth were very integral in facilitating that kept moving.
Yeah. So it sounds like
there was grower leadership in it. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, being able to support the vision.
Yeah. And they were part of that because I presume the board's the same today. I do not know if it is or not, but we had like 9 grower members and then 3 research Jim Cook's, you know, he was a legend in his lifetime, and just learned so many things from him. And there was many other researchers involved in that. There's a lot of names that I've forgotten, but I read obituaries, and man, we're losing them. And long history with what they've done to improve agriculture in the Pacific Northwest.
So when your board first got together and really hashed out some of the vision for that organization, how is what it is today a part of what you envisioned?
Well, the original vision, I would say it would have been tough to find somebody in that room that said we had to do more than no-till. That was the goal. There was quite a lot of this stuff now, regenerative ag, multi-species, all of that stuff was not even mentioned back then. We were trying to master no-till, make it consistent, profitable, competitive. The implications to reducing topsoil loss was so apparent and provable, and that was the easy part. But to be more efficient on input use, those type of things. That was one of the hopes, that we were going to improve organic matter quicker than it is happening just with no-till. There's been some disappointment there that the process, and we know now why. So there was a lot of things there that we didn't even envision that is sort of the priority today. No-till is just a small part of it.
So they've taken the vision and really run with it now.
Well, I know there's a group, they're all part of that direct seed group that are sort of got a biological group set up. What Eric is doing with the goats, that was a very successful. The other part of Eric's experience here, he had a very good livestock herdsman manager. She has both beef and goats, and the way she managed that was very efficient. I'm very impressed with what she did there, and found out when I visited her up the road a couple times, she has sold goats to Will Harris in Georgia. So that indicates to me that she has some very good meat genetics in her goats.
Yeah, the good management is, I think, one of the critical pieces of that. I think there's definitely some lessons to be learned in that. What did you see in the kind of good management, aside from the likelihood that there was good meat genetics there?
Well, the way she managed the herd, electrified net fencing, guard dogs, and she had a couple Peruvian herders in a camper on the field for the entire summer she was there. And, you know, the goats weren't out, and I doubt if she had any predator loss. But then managing the rotation through the probably 20-acre parcels that I think she ended up with around 800 goats, something like that on that before the summer was over. They quickly realized they didn't have enough there and brought some more in, and it still wasn't enough.
Wow. That must have been a really great cover crop stand.
The regrowth, they ate it down. It looked like there was nothing left. And by October, the regrowth on those first patches they grazed, 2 or 3 feet tall and thick. It was just incredible. That gets you excited about the potential there.
What experiments or trials really stand out, as I said, in retrospect, over the course of your career, both that you've engaged with the public research community and on your own?
Well, I mentioned that this conservation tillage effort at Pullman, that was way back probably in the 70s, early 80s, where they went to three-year rotation using the chisel plow. That was the first one. Changed how we did it and led us into no-till. The visit to the Dakota Lakes Research Farm, looking at incorporating warm season crops somehow into the rotation. Trying to take advantage of what science is learning, you know, and we're on the early stages of applying that to production practices and dealing in climate change is going to maybe provide some opportunities for more warm season crops to be part of the mix. Mm-hmm. The challenge of less summer rainfall is a hurdle that's getting higher. I think learning and having the livestock management capability available, like this effort we had across the road with this 30-acre parcel, the livestock owner did the fencing, and we had water available there. We didn't have to haul water, so that's another big issue on the cropland. Eric had to haul water for the goats, and just a side note, Eric's got a hired man that's mostly retired, but he's close to 80 and has worked on their farm since he was 16 years old.
Oh, we heard about him on the podcast.
And I met Carl on the road one day, hauling water. And I asked him, I said, Carl, did you ever imagine in your career on Odeberg Farms, you'd be hauling water for goats?
What did he say to that?
Well, he says, no, I didn't.
Oh, goodness.
But yeah.
So what is the most interesting thing you've learned from a past trial as it's happened when you were farming and in trying to kind of translate these and apply them, you know, the big ideas on the ground while you're farming?
Well, a lot of Jim Cook's work. Mm-hmm. As far as root disease pathogens, and just an aside from Jim Cook's work, I'm very suspicious that our soil biology has changed pretty dramatically from the days that he did his work, because I'm seeing very vivid instances of no green bridge impact where 20, 30 years ago would have been very severe. And I've been trying to get researchers interested in taking a look at that, because if you look, these farm publications now, a lot of the corn and soybean, what I call progressive cropping system management, is they're planting green. They're planting the new crop in a living crop. And it's getting either roller crimped or roller crimped and sprayed. And seeding into that sod with a low disturbance drill, to me, is the absolute best way in an annual cropping system to have very little disturbance. That top area with all the living roots growing, just would cut down in this part of the world, tillage erosion, those types of things. Your seed zone would be a little drier than if it wasn't a plant growing there. looking at one of our challenges is seed zone compaction in spring seeding has been a problem in this country because that top stays wet so long. And we can get on there with these low disturbance drills. And we can do a good job of seeding, get a stand, where in the old days we had tillage. If you seeded too wet, you paid for it. Poor stands and these single disc drills have allowed us to seed successfully into that, but it's led to seed zone compaction, which has hurt us. We've gone to a hoe drill and have less of that as an issue, but it's moving too much dirt on steep ground. I don't like that. If we didn't have to worry about Green Bridge, it would give us some more flexibility in seeding activities and even rotation activities. And the need to spray out everything before we plant, give us a longer window there. It would have to be with a very low disturbance drill if you seeded before spraying. But I'm suspicious that something has changed in soil biology that we do not have the Green Bridge impact that we used to. And I'd like somebody to prove me wrong. But I've had Tim Pollitz to my farm and showed it a neighbor that seeded garbs the day after they sprayed very lush spring barley volunteer. And this was after the beans had sprouted and were coming up, and found no sign of any kind of disease on those garbs. And the garbs were pretty susceptible to Green Bridge root disease activity. And I personally had it on my farm several times. Clint's done a couple things that in my generation would have been very risky Green Bridge influence, and saw no sign of it. So I know it makes the weed scientists nervous looking at Italian rye survivability and all that kind of stuff. But if we can push out there and have less glyphosate and seed into a sod, it's much better, I think, for soil quality and sustainable resource management.
Maybe there'll be some research colleagues listening to this podcast and hear your call. But also, you know, it is interesting. Of course, in agriculture, there's trade-offs for everything. And one of the things you did just give a nod to is the weed scientist cringing. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about with your long-term legacy in no-till, what is your take on herbicide resistance? And how do we, continue to keep no-till sustainable while also making sure that we're managing that trade-off?
Well, to me, the weed resistance thing, and you know, back in my days and being advisory committees, the overuse of specific herbicides that has created this problem. And as you look at what's happening now with multi-chemistry resistance in some of these plants, we're spraying those chemicals on the crop later in the season, you know, when the fruit is on the plant, and we're just getting more chemical in the food supply. And, you know, Clint's done some Roundup resistant spring canola. We've been fortunate in warding off Italian ryegrass. We've stayed in the seed business. We were one of the last winter wheat seed breeders in the Palouse region, which left because of goat grass. But a lot of it was just a lot of effort to prevent escapes. And I think this multi-species cover cropping, there's an opportunity there to address weed concerns. The very successful ones are making that happen. But I don't see any of that happening in the publicly funded land-grant university research arena.
The cover crops?
No, well, utilizing multi-species cover crop for weed control.
Oh, I think, isn't the PNW, we'll have to hear from Clint about how the PNW cover crop project. But I do think that's one of their goals. But what are other, you know, are there some other management strategies that you've thought about or used throughout the years?
We've had plenty of, not so great outcomes on some of the things we're trying to do with cover crops and grazing. We just were struggling to get the forage value. What's so exciting about Eric? He just tremendous success with that. And that's exciting. Clint's got his seed for next year already. We're going to have it on our farm. And I'm excited to see that.
Well, so that is one of the tools that you're excited about.
I'm becoming more convinced that the quickest way to regenerating soils is going to include multi-species livestock on the ground. That's going to be a very slow integration, likely, because we still got a generation of farmers that were so glad to see the last head of livestock leave.
So they don't have to get up Sunday morning when everything's out on the road.
Right.
Or in the neighbor's place.
So you're a Montana girl. But there's some people starting to have success. You know, the successes in the Pacific Northwest have been pretty limited compared to other regions with summer rainfall.
Yeah, it turns out rain helps.
Rain helps in dryland cropping regions, yes. So we got more challenges, but we still have good dirt. Blessed with that. So
what's the most fun thing about trying new stuff on the farm?
Well, anticipation that you're going to have success and be able to move the goalposts. That's the goal. Like I said, early on, we thought if we mastered no-till, we wouldn't have to move the goalposts. But we found out different. And it's going to take more. And it's going to take more management. And the pressure for the next generation that really, truly want to keep the goalposts moving is a much bigger challenge than I had, in my view. And I'm just trying to help keep that generation inspired and motivated and contribute. You know, I've got time to read books, whatever. Still have a passion for contributing to that process.
Oh, you're one of those landlords now who's excited about soil health.
Yeah. Well, sometimes Clint, I'm sure he's trying to sort out which idea that he should give some credence to.
I hear
he has more than one landlord with this very passionate about how their ground is farmed.
Well, you know, I hear that it's really great to have landlords who care about soil health, and it's a really important part of that journey, but it can sometimes be a mixed blessing.
Yeah.
That's the word on the street anyway.
I see, yeah.
What's the most annoying thing about trying new stuff on the farm?
Well, failures. You know, and that's the other part of it was that any of the stuff we tried, I was very cautious about not taking too much financial risk. And because the last thing I wanted to do was to fail financially. And some of the ideas we've had through the years, you know, when Dave Barton was with us, he was monitoring a lot of sugar level in the plants and trying foliar feeds. And we thought there was an opportunity to make a lot of progress there. And it was just tough to get any long-lasting benefits on some of the stuff we were doing there. This sap analysis that a lot of these biological guys are using now appears to me that it is going to be a very valuable management tool, which is a whole new arena that's happened since I've retired. So we'll see. And then, you know, quicker analysis of soil, the biological activity, to be able to monitor certain management practices. And the other part of that is some of this doesn't happen quickly. You do a one-year trial and it's not enough.
Replication?
Replication, year over year over year, cropping system changes, and it is a challenge to... I guess some things have short-term success looks. There's other things we may have given up on that we gave up too early. I can't give you any specific. Well, we did Lyme trials in Vico many years ago, and we did not find a lick of crop yield difference on our farm.
Okay, careful here. Now, how?
Well, I'm telling you, we expected some.
Well, how much lime did you put down? How did you decide?
Variable rates. Mm-hmm. We worked with. He's from the Midwest. Has a lab. Sent him soil samples and did some micronutrient stuff. We had two different lime components involved, up to a couple ton per acre. And I don't remember what the bottom rate was, mm-hmm. but this was when Dave Barton was with us, and we had the plots georeferenced, and we did follow up yield data on that on our farm probably for 6 or 8 years and did not get a lick of response, but it was in the mid fives, something like that. It wasn't real poor.
So maybe you averted crisis rather than, or like you, maybe you not crisis, but maybe you averted going down more where you would have lost more yield, but well, that's a lot harder to measure.
We haven't gone back to those plots. Eric Odeberg did a field right next to us, a ton of lime on. I actually had some pretty good data there just on my farm. Our farm was a little higher disturbance, hoe drill versus Eric's single disc drill, to a neighbor that used a moldboard plow, to some cousins that were more minimum tillage. And we did some 2-inch, 4-inch, 6-inch increments and saw the impact of Eric's 1-ton application. He had some advantage in the 2-inch. And the rest of them, even the moldboard plowed stuff was, you thought there would have been more mixing or whatever, but very similar to our no-till ground as far as the stratification of a pH. The other thing that we have done is some of my looking at seed zone compaction, looking at soil amendments. We're using primarily gypsum now for our sulfur source. And we feel we're getting some soil amendment benefit from that. We don't have measurable, this is conjecture or whatever, but we feel, for a number of reasons, it's the only soil sulfur, fertilizer sulfur source that does not lower pH. Has an implication of influencing the aluminum toxicity impact.
It does. The sulfur complexes with the aluminum.
And there's some things about calcium that we're learning about, but we've been convinced that that's helped us. Our soil analysis of sulfur has risen dramatically versus the days we were using liquid at higher rates even. But much better sulfur content in the soil. That's when I pulled out looking for compaction issues that were, I think nearly all of the Vico group now is using gypsum now for their sulfur source.
And have you seen it affect the compaction?
You know, a hoe drill going in the fall in dry conditions, and it appears that ground does not have the hardness, you know, in real dry conditions that, well, we've gone past that. All the farms getting gypsum now. But the first few years, we felt there was some benefit there on soil structure. Yeah, and there's been times where it's been cheaper, but we feel that gypsum's been a good thing.
Neat. I will say with your lime experience out here in Genesee, you guys, I'm sure, have very high buffer capacity. And so I'm going to guess that it probably would take an incredible amount of lime to really start to impact pH just because of how high, especially in high organic matter soils.
I think Eric Odeberg has limed most of his farm, I think, at a ton. And you might talk to him as far as what he's seen and feels with the investment he's made there.
So, Russ, if you could talk to yourself when you were a beginning farmer, what would you tell yourself?
So I sort of fell into the situation on that conservation district board that was, I guess, it just opened up my eyes and the realization that you know, I've got a lifetime here to make my mark, and it's obvious we've got to change how we farm. That motivated me to sort of what I say is do your homework. Look for successes, go to conferences, travel, read. And I was close to the research community. You know, we're very blessed here with two land-grant universities within a 25-mile radius of our farm.
And a lot of people that really care about doing good work.
The access to a lot of talented scientists, to me, was something I should take advantage of. And, you know, I had input on projects and direction. It was a internal motivation that something I recognized early in my career. And I just was blessed to have to be into that situation and said, yes, and I'll do it. And the other part of it for me to this day, I don't think we have enough teaching in agriculture, teaching the environmental implications of how we produce food. And I've been to other countries, Switzerland, where you don't have a right to be a farmer. You've got to go to school and pass tests, which is a very interesting thing. You just don't have the right with inheritance to do that. I look at 4-H programs that, you know, I've thought we should have an environmental stewardship track in those to get that whole process in the minds of people, because I'm a firm believer at this stage of the game, we've got to treat the planet better than we are. Agriculture is a major player in the implications of human influence over climate change. And if we would get young people looking at that, it would encourage more non-ag people. It would encourage STEM students. We need all of those working with us to help us do a better job. FFA programs, recognizing the implications of tillage on topsoil loss, wherever it may be. David Montgomery's books, Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, that was so comforting to read that book and just felt better about what you believed in, because he's got documentations over thousands of years of the rise and fall of human civilization based upon how they treated the natural resources. The problem with that is humans keep repeating past mistakes, and somehow we've got to have the stewardship commitment, the recognition of the need on the producer level to be convinced that we've got to do a better job in not just raising cheap food, not just raising bushels, but foods that are nutrient dense, that are healthy, and there's opportunity there. If we have everybody moving in the same direction, we could be advancing much quicker than we are. That's one of the things I've seen. You know, I don't have any of my kids are farming, got grandchildren. I'll have great grandchildren, but we've got to treat this planet better than we are now if those succeeding generations are going to have the same opportunity we had for life on this planet. And we're so blessed in this country, in this region. You know, our family got a start from an immigrant from Luxembourg in 1908, and he come to this North American continent not knowing where he would end up, but he wanted to farm someday. Just that legacy passed down, I've just felt that I just had a responsibility to respect that and carry it on and give the next generation the opportunity and the motivation to continue to do better.
Thank you for sharing that. That was very well said.
And you know, that the other part of my career is we've had some good friends in Australia. Actually, the start of Vico, 1998, we hosted an Australian exchange student on our farm, ended up running our first no-till drill for the year, and he went back to Australia and ended up being the executive director of one of the no-till organizations down there.
Are you saying your passion for no-till has went viral? Because you've also been invited to speak a lot of places. You've been featured in magazines.
Well, yeah, I've had a passion for what I do. And
you're in a textbook, too.
Yeah. Just feel so blessed to have the opportunity I've had. And feel very passionate about understanding that we've got to do better. We've got to do better. And we've got to look at the big picture stuff and look farther out. Looking 100, 200, 300 years out, we don't do that. We're pretty short term. And I served on the board of a publicly held corporation, and that was one of my frustrations with that. It's all about near term shareholder value, and it's just a different situation than being the boss and making those decisions yourself and looking longer term.
Well, you've heard about the people in the rainforest who they plant seeds of tree. Their traditional tree takes 100 years or more to grow and mature. So they plant the seeds for that they're never going to harvest from, but they do it for posterity. I mean, that's right. Some really long-term, long-sighted yes. management.
It is. Yeah.
So, well, Mr. Zenner, I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing all of your thoughts and lessons learned throughout your long career as one of the leading cropping systems innovators in our region. Thank you so much
thank you,
for
Carol.
The time.
Yeah, appreciate it. And I encourage you to keep up your good work. We need more scientists that believe in this and have a passion for it, and it helps us all.
Well, it's not possible alone. Really appreciate the support. Thank you so much again for being on the podcast, and we'll look forward to talking again soon.
We have talked a lot today of my activities through the years, and before we finish up here today, I would like to acknowledge the support of my wife, Kathy, of 58 years, and our family that has supported and believed in what we were doing on our farm. My involvement in all the off-farm activities wouldn't have happened without her belief in the value of what we learned from the time spent in meetings locally and the travel to other regions. She's been very involved in our Shepherd's Grain market promotion efforts, and in recent years, our participation in everything from farmers market activities to many in-store promotions for Zacha hummus. And her contribution to all the major decisions on our farm have been invaluable. Thank you, Kathy.
As always, a big thank you to our guests today for sharing their wealth of knowledge and experience with us. This podcast is produced by the PNW Farmers Network team with music credit to Carlos Flores. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers alone and do not represent that of the PNW Farmers Network or any associated agencies. Please remember that experimental results will vary, and listeners are encouraged to try things at home. If you like what you heard, please support this work by sharing, rating, and reviewing. And do consider joining us as a guest or nominating a friend who is trying things on their farm. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next time, happy trials.